Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Raya Affairs. My name is Nicola, and I'll be your host for this episode. Raya is a youth-led international think tank that translates the abstract world of international affairs by simplifying rather than generalizing. Raya is a place where you come to learn about the stories and worries of political leaders, the behind-the-scenes of decision-makers, and how politics impacts and changes your life. This is Raya Affairs, filling you in wherever you are. As always, we start with a disclaimer that expressed opinions in this episode are welcome, even though they are not a direct reflection of Raya, as we specialize in unbiased writing. This episode is the fourth in a series of six as part of the IE Raya Summer Research Program of 2025. Raya has invited 12 IE University students to join our think tank and spend 9 weeks researching a figure from around the world to try to answer a simple question. Are they a climate leader? During their research, students have done a deep dive of the person's background, policies, and the impact of said policies in an effort to bring light to the diverse ways in which every person, no matter the role they play in society, can contribute to the global climate change policy framework. In today's episode, we will be focusing on Grace Fu, Minister for Sustainability and the Environment in Singapore. Here with us, we have Gaspar Brabant and Pilar Gonzalez. Welcome to Raya Affairs, guys. It's a pleasure to have you here, and thank you very much for joining me today. Would you like to introduce yourself to our audience, please?
Hi, I'm Pilar. I'm a now third-year international relations and business administration student at IE, and I'm from Argentina. I'm very happy to be here today.
Hello, everyone. I'm Gaspar, a second-year student at IE, who I study international relations. I'm French, born and raised in Paris, and I'm really looking forward to this podcast.
Great, guys. Thank you very much for the introduction. And before we start, I'll ask you to answer our usual ice-breaking questions. So, could you tell us which leader, either dead or alive, who has impacted the world, would you want to have a conversation with, and why?
Well, for me, the leader I would like to have a conversation with is currently alive. However, she's not a political leader, but it's Marina Abramović. She's a Serbian and, like, kind of the creator of performative art, and I would take her art in a more political way, I think, because she brought very new ideas that were very politicized for many years of her works, and she was brought up in a time that was very politically challenging, very turbulent as well.
I think I choose Henry Kissinger. I'm very passionate about international politics and geopolitics. I think he was a great diplomat. He made pragmatic diplomatic moves. I think about the Shuffle diplomacy between Egypt, Israel, and Syria after the Kippur War. I also think about the opening of the US-China relationship, which is today one of the main axes of global geopolitics. So yeah, I'd love to have a little conversation with him to ask him a few questions.
Great. Those are really interesting picks, guys. I have to say, Pilar, I think you are the first one to choose someone not from the political sphere, but that was definitely interesting to hear from you. And well, regarding Henry Kissinger, I would love to have a conversation with him as well. So yeah, really, really interesting. Controversial figure, but definitely interesting. It would be great to spend a couple of hours at dinner with him. So thank you very much, guys. And I would say that now we can start our conversation about your report on Grace Fu. Could you please summarize for us how her professional background in the private sector, and especially her personal history as the daughter of James Fu, a key figure in Singapore's early political history, shaped her decision to join politics and her approach to environmental policy?
So yeah, so Grace Fu is basically the daughter of James Fu, who was the press secretary of Lee Kuan Yew, which is the founding father of Singapore, as we all know, from, I think, 1972 to 1993. So yeah, so James Fu was at the same time the press secretary, so the highest ranking office for journalists, but he was also Cold Stone Detainee in 1963. So Operation Cold Stone was an operation conducted by the People Action Party, which is a main Singaporean party, to cut down on journalists and suspected communists ahead of the 1963 general election. So Grace Fu, because she grew up with the founding generations of Singapore and alongside the steps of her father, knows the pros and the cons of joining politics in Singapore. She also worked, as you mentioned, in the private sector. So she graduated from the National University of Singapore in 1985, I think, if I remember well. And she joined different corporations, including one regional bank in Singapore, before joining in 1995 the PSA, which is the Port of Singapore Authority, where she understood how vulnerable Singapore is to climate change and how dependent the city-state is on global trade. So as I said, Grace Fu joined politics in 2006. She was convinced by Lee Hsien Loong, which is the eldest son of Lee Kuan Yew, to run for election. She joined because, as she said, I think in the podcast, she didn't like the way some policies were implemented and wanted to have an impact on the history and the future of Singapore for future generations. As, for example, she has, I think, two or three children. So yeah, she wanted to have an impact, change the way the policies were implemented, and implement some feedback mechanism also that was lacking at the time.
Well, that's a really interesting history. Thank you, Gaspar. And in your report, you explain how the belief that the survival of the island is at stake is a recurring theme in the Singaporean narrative, one that has historically helped the city-state to adapt to challenges and innovate. Could you please walk us through how this survival narrative and this legacy of an existential threat always being present has shaped Singapore's approach to climate policy today, and why Fu sees climate change as the new defining survival challenge for the city-state?
Yeah, sure. So, as we all know, Singapore gained its independence in 1965 when it was expelled from the Federation of Malaysia because of economic disagreements. So at the time, as a quote by Lee Kuan Yew states it, he says, "We're a Chinese island in the Malay Sea." So the two threats at the time of the independence were Malaysia and Indonesia. So first, Indonesia, when Singapore and Malaya, which is the northern part of the islands of Malaysia, decided to merge in 1963. Indonesia and its leader at the time, Sukarno, declared war on the Federation, which is called Confrontasi. So when Singapore gained independence, the city-state was wondering if Indonesia was still going to be a threat to the city-state. Then we also have Malaysia, which was basically hostile to Singapore because of the different communities and ethnic communities in Singapore. So Singapore is composed of a majority of ethnic Chinese and has a very small population. So in 1965, it was 2 million with no resources, no land, basically nothing except the brain of its citizens. It was in an environment where there was also Malaysia, so had, I think the population was around 10 million people, and Indonesia had 100 million people, with both these countries having a majority of Malay, so ethnic Malays, who were Muslims. So there was history of confrontation between these ethnicities in Singapore, notably the 1963 riots in Singapore. So Singapore had reasonable grounds to feel threatened by its neighbors. To counter the threat, it embarked an extraordinary economic growth, mostly through foreign direct investments from American firms, and it was coupled with state capitalism. It also created what is now the biggest army in Southeast Asia, the Singaporean Armed Forces. But the threat shifted now, and since the 1990s, it's becoming climate change, because, as you know, Singapore is highly vulnerable to climate change for two different reasons. First, the rise in sea levels. So depending on the different emission scenario, Singapore could witness a rise in the sea level up to 1.23 meters by 2100. And climate change will also increase the frequency and the intensity of extreme climatic events, such as heat waves and rainfalls. These two phenomena made climate change the new threat for Singapore.
And you also describe in detail Singapore's environmental and economic vulnerabilities. You already mentioned a couple, but mainly we're talking about, as Gaspar rightly said, so rising sea levels, extreme weather events, and the heavy reliance on global trade and imports. So to address these challenges, the government, led by Grace Fu, in February 2021 launched the Singapore Green Plan 2030. What can you tell us about this initiative and how is it linked to Fu's personal stakes? And what does it tell us about her climate leadership?
Okay, so the Green Plan, it was launched in 2021, as you said. And I believe it's the biggest framework or foundation, framework that the country has created in order to address this really intense global issue. And the plan is composed of five pillars, which is city and nature, energy reset, green economy, resilient future, and sustainable living. And all these different pillars aim to address all different kinds of areas affected by climate change, for example, introducing the concept of circular economy, introducing education programs to educate people about recycling and sustainability, changing to renewable energy, and becoming less dependent on trade, since it's an island and it trades a lot with different countries, but that may be an issue because of the supply chains being affected by climate change. And so it's addressing all these kinds of issues along with the sea level rise that we mentioned in their resilient future pillar, I think, because it focuses on their infrastructure. And so with this plan, it's able to adapt and mitigate against these problems. And how is this linked to Fu? Well, so it's going along with the idea of survival, the stake that Singapore that we've mentioned. And it's continuing this legacy, how they must adapt to survive, like Espa mentioned. And it's involves her private sector background because she directly has firsthand knowledge about how trade is affecting, how trade is going to be affected by climate change. As we saw from her background at working at PSA, she had a very high position, so she knows very much the ins and outs, and she was part of the Singaporean elite, so she knows how the country's always at stake. And also, she's in a position where very few women are in Singapore, so during her time in government right now, she's emphasizing inclusivity, and in her speeches, she's really focusing on intergenerational responsibility and societal transformation, which are all very important when making a change like she's trying to do with the Green Plan. And she's also trying to really shift the narrative. And you can really see this the way she talks in her speeches. And as we mentioned before, Singapore has always had to adapt and create new technologies to survive. But she's kind of trying to shift this view from being a technocratic adaptive leader to a call to action and lead by example. And she's trying to position the country itself as a leader in climate change for other countries to follow by example in what Singapore is doing.
And as you said, Pilar, the Green Plan was presented as a necessity of survival for the country, aiming at achieving domestic food resilience, energy efficiency, and a circular economy. So I wanted to ask you, how does Grace Fu's analytical approach help Singapore to reach these goals?
So initially, when we started exploring this area, we thought that she has an MBA, she studied accounting, so she came from a very analytical background. So in order to set clear goals, she uses clear performance metrics, and this can be seen through her policies and in the Green Plan with what they aim to do with their different plans. And she sees, for example, energy transition as both environmental necessity and economic. And an instance where she's being very analytic is, for example, the carbon tax, which I can get into more later. Before she was in the office, let's say, it wasn't very progressive, but her then taking on this role as the environmental and sustainability minister for Singapore, she has introduced a progressive tax system. So it's increasing every couple of years, which is really making a change compared to what it was doing before. And she's incentivizing innovation, and she's trying to overall reduce dependency on fossil fuels. And as for the part of the circular economy, she's really trying to support waste to energy technologies, and she's centralizing the waste management And she's turning all these goals that lots of countries have into very quantifiable that align with their environmental goals and still allow them to be competitive and grow economically.
And this seems like a very unique feature in her approach to climate action in Singapore. My next question is about what you identified as her defining moment. In the report, you identify her defining moment as the speech she gave on March 4th, 2021, launching the Singapore Green Plan, where she described climate action as a solemn pledge to our children and future generations. Why do you consider this speech such a turning point? And how did it change both the narrative of climate governance in Singapore and the public perception of Grace Fu as a leader?
So this speech that she gave that we chose as defining moment, it was a speech to launch the Green Plan that I just discussed. And it's significant because she was able to reframe climate action as a moral duty, a generational responsibility, trying to make it a unified mission for everyone and really creating a new perspective on this issue that the citizens of Singapore may not have had, that everyone needs to take accountability because it's going to harm everyone in the future, their children. And this can really be seen by her choice of diction in the speech. She uses a lot of we, a lot of us, and she creates a call to action overall. And she's really shifting from this technocratic perspective again in the speech to a more moral one. One could argue that this is the first time a Singaporean minister has placed this kind of attitude and civic responsibility at the center of climate discourse in the country. And something else that she did in the speech, which I thought was personally impactful, was she included a personal anecdote of a conversation that she had with her son. Her son basically asked her if she would have still had children if she knew about climate change and everything harmful it can bring. And she said yes, like she didn't, without a doubt, she said yes, because she believes in faith and that they'll work together to help and mitigate against climate change. And I thought this was really important because we were able to see Grace Fu in a new lens that we don't really get to see people in big positions. We normally see them as faraway entities, but we were able to see Grace Fu not only as a minister, but as a mother, as a civilian like us, facing the same issues, facing the same fears. And so I thought this was really impactful, how she's trying to change the perspective from just being a prime minister to a moral steward, a climate leader, and a mother at the end of the day. Like, she's really just a human being trying to do her job against climate change.
I think that is definitely really interesting, especially if we consider, you know, what we talked about before, her analytical approach, really like quantitative approach to policy. And on the other side, we have the human part of it. And this anecdote perfectly explained, you know, the two sides of the person. And that was definitely something that I found really interesting when reading your report. And in your report, you also examine three policies that reflect Grace Fu's strategic vision and influence: the carbon tax framework that we already mentioned before, the National Food Security Program, and the Resilient Infrastructure Initiatives. And I would like to start with the first one, so the carbon tax. And I would like to ask you, what is the history of this policy? How has it evolved over time? And what has been its impact? Because your report mentions that it has already influenced industries to cut emissions and adopt cleaner technologies. But some critics argue that it started too low to have a real impact. So what is your take on this issue?
Okay, so I'd like to start by answering the history of the carbon tax. So it was first introduced in Finland, I believe, around 1990 in order to assign financial costs to emissions in hope of reducing this negative externality and decrease the contribution to climate change. And now this policy is very popular. We see it in many countries, especially in the EU, we see it. And now in Singapore, it was introduced on the 1st of January 2019 in order to reach their goals of net zero emissions. The policy, in Singapore, it started off too low, I believe, and some people argue that. But their argument to this was that so people have time to adjust and plan ahead for this. And it was also the first carbon tax in Southeast Asia. So that was also another point that was really important. But the main purpose of this tax in Singapore was to incentivize renewable energy, and it was at $5 per ton from 2019 to 2023. And what's interesting, the IMF recommends this carbon tax to be at $75 per ton. So that's a really big difference on what the country started at to what it's recommended at. So that's why people argue that was starting at too low a price to make any difference. And we kind of saw the evidence in this because now Grace Fu has increased it, and she's planning on increasing the tax over the years. I think in 2024 it's $25 per ton, and in 2026 it'll be $45 per ton. But they want to use the revenue from the tax in order to invest in renewable energies. But their predicted revenue is 30 below what was expected. So you can really see there's troubles here. And then they're giving lots of carbon credits away to companies in order to for them to be able to adjust and plan ahead. However, their decisions on who gets carbon credits and how much they get is not very transparent to the public either.
And the second policy that you analyze is the so-called 30 by 30 initiative, which aims to build up the agri-food industry's capability and capacity to produce 30% of Singapore's nutritional needs locally and sustainably by 2030. Why is this so important for Singapore, and how do they plan on reaching this goal? What challenges is the initiative facing, and which steps have been taken to implement it?
So the 30 by 30 initiative is very important for Singapore because basically Singapore is dependent on imports, on global trade, and vulnerable to trade disruptions. In the past, different events reinforced both its dependency and vulnerability. For example, we can think of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, causing rising prices. And as Ukraine is a big producer of wheat, the consequences is that Malaysia couldn't feed its chicken and it had to ban exports to Singapore to protect and to safeguard its own chicken industry. We can also think of disease outbreaks such as the African swine fever, which is a highly contagious disease among pigs that contaminated Indonesian pigs in, I think, 2023. Singapore had to restrict imports from Indonesia, and those imports accounted for 15% of Singapore's total pork supply. These events are a threat to food security in Singapore, and that's why the policy is relevant. The question is now, how do they plan on reaching this goal? So the 30 by 30 initiative banks on three strategies. First, it develops high-tech facilities to produce sustainable food. It implements innovative methods of production, such as, for example, hydroponics or aquaponics, and also uses a lot of technology. We can think of smart sensors that monitor data, coupled with AI and also automation. Second, it also invests in capital. As you might know, Singapore has no resources, no land, no oil, basically nothing except the brain of its citizen. They train the workforce and develop new degrees in universities with programs, for example, in bioengineering. Lastly, the objective is to create outlets and markets for food, and especially for sustainably and locally produced food. Because if you produce food but you don't have anyone to sell it to, it's a bit useless. So that brings us to the challenges the policy faces. So the first challenge is the hawkers culture. So the hawkers culture is a culture where you have hawkers that basically sell cheap, good and local Singaporean food in centers like malls. And it's combined with the second challenge, which is the high cost of production of the local and sustainably produced food that inevitably translate into higher costs for consumers. So basically, the question one may ask is, why would you want to buy expensive, even if it's organic, locally produced and sustainable food, when you have cheap, good, local Singaporean food? So yeah, the high cost of production and the hawkers culture in Singapore are the two challenges this policy faces.
Well, that's a story that we already heard. Trying to balance the need for local sustainable production, but at the same time, you have the economic and social problem that derive from it, because obviously the prices are higher, and especially when you have global markets that can supply cheapest food. So that's definitely a problem for food security, I think, not only in Singapore, but obviously Singapore being so dependent on global trade, this is especially concerning for the small city state in the Indo-Pacific. And now I have a question regarding the resilient infrastructure initiatives, which is the third policy that you analyze in the report. You explain how the term resilience refers to the ability to reduce the magnitude and the duration of disruptive events. So the objective is to develop infrastructure that should be able to anticipate, absorb, adapt, or recover from potentially disruptive events. And in order to achieve these goals, the Singaporean government is implementing three different strategies: protect the coastline from sea level rises and inland floods, mitigate the so-called urban heat island effect, and greening the buildings. So what can you tell us about these three pillars of the country's environmental strategy? What are their specific goals? What progress has been made towards implementing them? And finally, why are they so crucial for Graceful's climate leadership?
I can start off by addressing the sea level rise and inland flooding part of this policy. So basically 30% of Singapore's land lies less than 5 meters above sea levels, which is very alarming due to its an immediate threat for the sea level rise. So within this part of the policy, they aim to guard low-lying coastlines against the projected sea level rise using nature-based solutions like mangroves, seawalls, and by improving their drainage systems in order to expand their rainwater storage capacity. So what they're aiming to do is creating a source pathway receptor to approach these drainage systems. So they'll be able to integrate full water flow from stormwater generation to potential flood zones and introduce multi-layered reservoir systems, like underground caverns, detention tanks, and tunnels. And this matters to her leadership because it's directly linked to the climate action, and especially when it comes to a matter of survival of Singapore. And her policy framing emphasizes proactive adaptation, and she's constantly working on this and aligns with her goals of making Singapore a regional model for climate resilience. However, this part of the policy has faced some critiques in a panel discussion, I think, when discussing what people can do for these changes, because they don't know when the floods are going to happen. She just tells people to check the weather out more recently, which angered a lot of the people that saw this speech, because they don't feel like it should be on them to be prepared when like a flood comes. Like, the government should do something about it so that they're not flooded. But yeah, she just said to check the weather. And then another critique that was made about this is when it comes to improving these areas to address the flooding, the government tends to focus more on the touristy areas. And so people that are in low-income areas, they're more severely affected, and they can't afford to not be in these areas because they just can't. They don't have the money to do that. And so there's a lot of inequality within the country, and it'll just worsen due to climate change.
Yeah, I wanted to tackle the two other pillars of this last policy. So concerning the urban heat island effect, UHI, which is basically when the air temperatures are hotter when there is urbanization, the goal is to make temperatures cooler and more livable for citizens. That can be done by greening the city. For example, putting more trees in natural parks cools the air down and creates more shadow, while also absorbing carbon dioxide. The design of buildings of different heights is also very important, so that the air flows better towards the pedestrians. To finish, the more efficient strategy is to adapt the materials, for example, using less reflective paintings on the buildings. The main cause of the UHI effect is the absorption of heat through materials. So if the materials absorb less, the temperatures will decrease. Finally, the last part of the infrastructure policy concerns the buildings industry. In Singapore, the buildings account for over 20% of carbon emissions. Singapore created the 80-80-80 policy to increase the energy efficiency of buildings.
Well, thank you very much, guys, for explaining these three policies that you analyzed in the report. This was super clear, and I hope our audience enjoyed as well to dive into the details and the technicalities of these different policies. And we almost made it to the end of the episode. I only have one question left, and it's a question that I asked all the different groups for this series on i.e. RAIA Summer Research Program on Climate Leaders. And basically, it is about kind of the bigger picture, because you spent 9 weeks researching Grace Fu. And after all that, I would like to ask you if, in your own words, if you believe that she should be considered, in fact, a climate leader. And beyond Singapore, what lessons can other small, vulnerable states or even larger nations learn from her approach to climate policy?
I believe that she has made great progress during her time as the Environmental and Sustainability Minister. So she should definitely be considered a climate leader, but not just in Singapore, but in a global stage. She has a vision. She understands the importance about the country's survival and what to do to survive, basically. And she's transformed environmental policy into the core pillar of national security. And she's moved beyond the technocratic style that the country has previously had. And she created a paradigm shift from engineering-focused adaptive to a value-based transformation with all the different policies that they have started to implement. She has this analytical approach as well that ensures the policies are measurable, enforceable, and aligned with the goals while adding empathy and emotion to the climate policies. So she's very action-oriented. She's done a lot of changes within the policies and improved them. For the part about the small states in this question, I think what they can learn from this approach is that they can leverage their vulnerability that they experience as being a small state as a catalyst for innovation. They have more urgency to adapt, and so they kind of need to use their soft power to lead by example. And for large nations, what they can take from Singapore and Grace Fu is that climate action must be cross-sectoral. It must be implemented in all kinds of areas and sectors in the country in order for it to be effective and make the most amount of changes. And public engagement is also key in this, because one person can't just make the change. It needs to be based on everyone.
To draw on Pilar's answer, I definitely think Grace Fu is climate leader. She's driving innovation and pushing further for climate transition in Singapore. If I think about what lesson can be learned of her approach to climate policy, I believe education is key. For example, if half of your population doesn't believe climate change is real, it's going to be a bit difficult to go green. So yeah, investing massively in education should be, in my opinion, the first step. Something also great with Grace Fu, and what we haven't mentioned yet, is that Grace Fu is very close to the citizens. 1 week, she's meeting with Xi Jinping on climate issues, and the week after, she's doing an event with citizens in Singapore. As in Singapore, the world politics is quite of a non-word. It's something it's not very talked about, so she's very close to the citizens. And when we look at her LinkedIn, her Instagram, her social media, yeah, she appears very close to Singaporeans. So yeah, I think education and being close and listening to citizens' needs is something that can be highlighted in Grace Fu's leadership.
Great. Thank you very much, guys, for your answers. It has been a pleasure to have you here. I would say that with this, we can end today's episode. Thank you very much again, Gaspar and Pilar, for joining me today. It has been a pleasure. I remember to our listeners that this has been the fourth in a series of 6 episodes as part of the IE RAIA Summer Research Program of 2025. To our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to check out Gaspar and Pilar report at raiagroup.org, and to follow us on social media to receive updates on new articles and contents. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll see you next time.